Hello and welcome to the premiere episode of the World Cinema Film Club. I'm your host, Edward Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, Professor Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello.
Now, if you are wondering what this new bonus episode is appearing in your feed, do not fear. We are not ending the Asian Cinema Film Club or rebranding. We are merely providing a little spin-off show to further expand our own cinematic tastes and cover a lot of films that we may otherwise not get to cover. Because obviously with the Asian Cinema Film Club, we cover Asian cinema, in case the title didn't make it clear enough. And of course, there is many aspects of world cinema that we obviously don't get to cover or to get to discuss. And we thought we would put together this little spin-off show to obviously hit some of those films that we may not get to have, and also have discussions about films that, again, we wouldn't get to have, which is the prime example for tonight's selection, as we're going to be talking about Aguri, The Wrath of God, a film which is a favourite of Stephen's and one that I was especially wanting to discuss with him. So it seemed like a perfect storm with eating the two ideas to put together this spin-off of our main show, and hopefully over the coming episodes get to discover some more world cinema they may have missed, get to talk about some favourites, and really sort of redefine the idea of what we think of when we think of world cinema. Because world cinema, the mere mention of it makes it brings to mind a lot of like the sort of art house and really sort of intelligent cinema, and sort of skips out on a lot of the fun cult side of things, a lot of sort of the more obscure genres of cinema, and certainly in a way eliminates a lot of the English language speaking countries which we don't believe to be included because they are using English as a first language, but obviously are still classed as world cinema. So to outline really for what we're going to be going for with this show, we're going to be eliminating cinema produced in America and Canada, and we're also going to be obviously eliminating all Asian cinema because we have our own show to cover all that. So the rest of the world is now an open buffet for us to pick and choose from, and hopefully we'll provide some interesting picks over the coming episodes of this sub-show. But Stephen, tonight we are obviously talking about Aguri, The Wrath of God from 1972, directed by Werner Herzog, who there's a fraction of people out there who probably know him best for his cameos and the likes of The Mandalorian and doing voice work on The Simpsons, or perhaps those nice documentaries about the Antarctic and The Grizzly Man. But for yourself, I mean, where does the interest in Herzog begin?
Well, I mean, this show's incredibly well timed. Obviously, I think we talk quite a lot offline, off air, and I'm a huge fan of like world cinema in general. We even did my own little podcast about it 3 or 4 years ago. So I'm really keen to talk about it. Now, Herzog is a director. I mean, I'm not going to say I've been into him my entire life, but I picked up like a DVD box set of his films, mostly the films he did with Kinski. So Aguirre, Fitzcarraldo, Nosferatu, Cobra Verde, and the My Best Friend documentary all in one. And I didn't really know what I was getting into. I knew of Werner Herzog. I mean, he's like this guy, like you say, he's an actor, he's a director, he makes dramatic films, he makes documentaries, he even directs operas. He's like this incredible polyglot. Anyway, I just remember putting on Aguirre, and this would have been 6 or 7 years ago, and it just blew me away. I don't often do this, but I'm going to quote somebody's quote, which I just think is so apt. You know Bill Hader, the American comedian actor?
Yes.
Yeah. So I was listening to something he was talking about this film, and he summed...
I think we watched the same video now.
He summed it up in saying, it's like someone went to the 16th century with a 16mm camera. And that's just what it is. It's just so, I don't know what it is. It's not about historical accuracy, but it's just so visceral and real. And then you've got this, again, we'll talk about, we've got this sort of central actor, Klaus Kinski, who, you know, we've seen around in other things. But here is just this force of nature, this barely holding it together animal man. We all hear all these crazy stories, and I'm sure we'll talk about them. But in this way, he's actually quite restrained. Although when you find out how they made it, it turns out he made it by knackering him out with arguments. And then, But yes, sorry, so yeah, it was that bunch of films. I haven't explored his whole back catalogue at all, but when you talked about this and you wanted to do this film, I thought, oh, excellent, because that's a film I love, and this is I don't think we're ever going to get a Gary Wrath of God on the Lamb cast, right? It's just not going to happen.
No.
I mean, Mr. Brook might vote for it, I suspect, but nobody else. So it's really cool to talk about it, because it's German language film, which, again, I don't think has a... Germany has a lot of really important directors, and really important in the early days of films, with sort of like the expressionist cinema and stuff like that, and some new wave stuff, things like Fassbinder. But yeah, I just love this a genuine auteur, I think, in every sense of the word. So yeah, I'm really, really keen to talk about it tonight. That was a ramble, but I think you can just tell I'm excited.
Yeah, it's perfectly fine. I mean, Herzog is this film. I worked with a guy called Sam when I was back when I was working at Borders, and he used to go on endlessly about his love for Herzog, and in particular Gary. So he was the one who first recommended this to me, and of course, me being someone who does everything directly means that it's took me till now to actually watch it. So
this is your first watch?
This is my first watch of Wrath of God. I've seen other bits and pieces of this. Like I saw Fitzcarraldo. Fitzcarraldo was the first one I watched because it had filtered through as one of my assignments. And from there, I saw Little Dieter Needs to Fly, which is a fantastic documentary about Dieter Dangler. And I've seen, it's mainly his documentaries that I've seen. It's just random that those have filtered through. So I've seen like Grizzly Man. And I saw Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, which I really enjoyed as well. And there's, I think when it comes to Herzog, he is one of these directors who's held in such high regard, but at the same time, he's someone who is very much a true original in every sense. He does things his own way. He doesn't storyboard everything. He just goes out and shoots things, and he has a man with so similar vision. The fact that he's worked with Kinski more times than any other director. Most directors work with Kinski once, and he's worked with Kinski 6 times. And the fact that they were friends, they were the best of friends and also the best of enemies. And I especially love the quote that Ebert said about Herzog, and he said that he's never created a single film that is compromised, shameful, made for pragmatic reasons, or uninteresting. Even his failures are spectacular.
Yeah, Ebert loved this film. I know that. But, yeah. That's an absolute quote. He's made a lot of stuff. We could do a whole year's worth of podcasting, I suspect, on Werner Herzog and his various activities. He's probably getting up there with our old friend from the Asian Cinema podcast, Takashi Miike, in how many movies. Probably hasn't done quite as many movies, but he does a lot of, like, say, like 40-minute documentaries and things like that. Just a fascinating character. And then his, I also like that his, again, watching this film, and you clued me into the DVD commentary on it, which was incredibly illuminating, because as suspected, sometimes he just shoots stuff that just happens to happen. It feels very much, like we talk about some of that golden age of Hong Kong cinema where they were just making it up as they went along.
Yeah,
that's Werner Herzog as well. He just, there was this, we saw some mice have babies on the boat, so I just filmed that for a minute. Or luckily there is a structure there. There's a general idea. There's characters and things like that. But he'll also just, this is the documentary filmmaker in him as well. And that is just that, I'll just film this thing that happened and doesn't really mean anything. And he's actually quite against a lot of deep discussion about symbols and things like that. It's in some ways he's not canvassing, the whole art house thing where we'll talk about the symbology of something. Here it's the monk was a bad man because I really don't like what the Catholics did in 16th century South America. There's no depth to it. This guy's a shit, and I'm going to display him as a shit, and that's what I think of it. And I like that kind of brutal honesty in the fact there's that whole film sued stuff just gets put to one side, and he points the camera But there is art to it as well. He does surround himself with really talented people. And again, that that DVD commentary, you know, he gives a lot of credit to his cinematographer to the things he's done, because there's some still interesting stuff going on. So, yeah, let's talk more about the film.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned already a cinematographer. This is cinematographer Thomas Munch, who was worked with him extensively over the course of his career. I mean, he would go on to do Fitzcarraldo. It's funny the fact that you think that the same guy who is the cinematographer on this would also do the cinematography for Id, the British-German movie about football hooliganism. And he also did Herzog's Even Dwarfs Started Small. The film itself, if you're obviously not familiar with the film, it opens on Christmas Day in 1560. So it's great in the fact that if you want something alternate for your Christmas viewing, you can put this on. Better than Die Hard. And here we follow the Spanish conquistadors who are on the search for the fabled country of El Dorado and the city of gold. And basically we're opening them, they're trekking through the Andes Mountains, and it's such an epic shot that you're seeing right from the start. You're seeing this mountainous range, and they're all sort of like carrying like cannons and all this equipment, and they're all going single file down this pretty much like what looks like they're walking down the side of a mountain. It's like these slippy steps that they're having to go down, and they're pulling horses, and they've got a sedan chair. It's just like the most ill-equipped party, and this is in the opening segment of the film, and it only gets really worse from there as you see how this group of guys are basically trying to battle their way through this jungle that's full of mud and it's densely forest, and they're just very ill prepared for it. And they get to New Year's Eve and they realize that they can't continue the way that they're going forward, and they send a group of guys to scout ahead. And it's really these guys that are scouting ahead that we follow over the course of the film. Amongst them is our man Klaus Kinski, who here plays such a Lupe de Aguilera, who's kind of an agitator and also equally driven in the pursuit of finding this city of gold, but at the same time having to deal with the diplomacy of the group as he battles for sort of control of the quest, really.
Well, yeah, so at the opening shot, well, this film I will always remember for two things: the opening shot and the ending shot. They are, you know, they bookend some marvellous stuff in between, but that opening shot is just epic. It's like, has he got like something like 400 actors? Well, 400 yes. Extras. They're basically people from sort of Peruvian Highlanders, so that he's invited to come and help him. He's got 400 of them, and like I said, they're all trekking single file up and down this mountain, and to the left it's all like fog. And again, listen to the commentary, is so illuminating, because he says, well, actually it was really foggy, but just luckily when we started filming the fog moved away and it stays on the left hand side, so you get the sense of, you know, there's this, we don't know what's over there, you know, death probably, and it's just hundreds of people. And you think, yeah, that's the kind of thing that big budget films do. Yeah, that's a Spielbergian kind of excess. But no, these are just 400 people he's managed to talk into helping. And the whole budget of the film is what, $350,000? Which even...
yes, it's about that.
Yeah, even taking account that was not in 1970-odd, That's not very much, and he is effectively an art house. And this is quite early in his career as well. And I think most of the money went on Kinski.
So, it did actually.
I think half of it was his wages or something. But that's brilliant. And then we'll talk about the end of the end. But it's just so memorable. And but then after that giant sort of panoramic, almost, which you can have it panoramic in like a, in this aspect ratio, it's like a 4:3 aspect ratio, it's not widescreen or anything, and then it all becomes very claustrophobic and you're in the jungle, and it looks so realistic, mostly because it is, he's not retaking shots, you know, people get their heads stuck on branches and horses get awkward and people get know, vines and stuff tangled up in their armor, and it just looks real. Like, again, I go back to, it's just like somebody's turned up in the 16th century with a camera and just filmed it, documentary. So it's got that whole, what do they call it, cinema verite style about it. You know, if it rains or on the water, you'll get a splash of water on the lens. He doesn't go for these perfect shots. It just feels like we're there, and you feel complicit in it, and you'll feel like you're in it. And you also realise that the Spanish conquistadors are fucking idiots.
They're very ill-prepared to deal with this whole situation, it has to be said. Because, I mean, first of all, who takes a cannon down the Amazon? Much less a horse and royalty. And there's all these people who have no right being in the Peruvian jungle.
And they even call it out, Pizarro. So this is kind of based on real stories, but he's taken two or three sort of expeditions by various people and sort of combined them into one. And you know, Aguirre himself was a real live character, but actually sounds even worse than Kinski's version, actually. We'll get to more of that at the end. But, you know, he wasn't with Pizarro, but they've just sort of combined them together and used elements of these sort of fractions of sort of first and second generation historical documents, and he's just pulled them together. And I think he jokes about it, doesn't he, in the commentary?
Yeah, that he says he made up the opening text, which is supposedly taken from a monk's diary who was part of the expedition. But he openly admits that he made it up, and was inspired by a different monk on a different expedition. And the historian would say, oh, where did you get this? And he's like, oh, I got it in some book. But I forget the title.
Herzog is a virulent self-promoter. And, you know, lots of the stories that we hear about him and Kinski aren't necessarily entirely true. And indeed, Kinski has pushed back on a few of them. Well, he did before he passed away. But Gaspar de Carvajal, the monk, you know, was a real person. Pizarro, the original guy that's running this exhibition, is a real guy. Aguirre is a real guy. They just maybe weren't all together at the same time. But they've got all these people. They give up and say, just go and have another. You 40 of you, go and spend another week. Otherwise, we're just giving up. And as you know, El Dorado was just made up by the Incas to fool the, I think basically to get the Spanish out of their way after the Spanish killed them all. So who do they send? They said, so there's another soldier. I can't remember his name.
Oh, so we got the...
Ursua. Ursua is the commander, right?
Yes.
And his mistress... You know, this woman that he's seeing whilst he's out conquistadoring, she goes with him. And Pizarro says, yeah, I don't really approve of that, but there you go. Aguirre sends his daughter, his 15-year-old daughter. Yeah, I don't really approve of that either, but there you go.
Yeah, so she should have been with the nuns rather than in the middle of the Peruvian jungle. And yes, I kind of agree, really.
Yeah. But again, that really happened. That's the thing. The ridiculous shit really happened in the real stories that he's drawing from, the real historical stories. These two did take these women with them to unexplored Central America, South America. Oh, it's ridiculous.
We also got the nobleman Guzman, who apparently led a charge on in a battle prior to this.
Yeah, 20 years prior.
And they basically, he's been resting on his laurels ever since, but he's just there to represent the royal house of Spain.
Yeah.
But his allegiances, I would say, are shaky at best.
I think his allegiance is with his stomach, basically. And we have, obviously, Carvajal, the monk, for whom is the ostensible sort of narrator of the tale.
And he's also there to convert all these savages to the way of Christianity, because that's just what local tribes would want, isn't it? When you mind your own business and you got some guy trying to convert you to Christianity.
Well, the Roman Catholic Church has a lot to answer for around the world, not least in Central and South America. But can't help thinking they won, which is very, very sad indeed. So this sort of ragtag, and I think there's... I think this is 40 of them, but the numbers go down fairly rapidly.
It is, yeah. It's right, pretty much from the start. They lose a bunch when one of the rafts gets caught in a whirlpool, and it's also when they're like assigning like who's going to go ahead. He's all like, "And I'll keep all the slaves." It's like, oh great. So all the hired help is now with the guy who's not going anywhere. Just to go back to that opening shot, then you were saying obviously they brought in local guys from like the Highlands. He was saying that during the filming that they weren't used to the altitude, so they had constantly had them passing out and they had to be rescued off the mountain. And when they're walking along, you could see how sheer the cliff face is to the right of them. It's like a sheer drop.
I mean, it's
see like that cage fall off.
Indeed, yeah. They turn to shot. Somebody drops something, don't they? And you see it smashed out. I mean, health and safety be damned. This is. I can't believe more people haven't died making Werner Herzog movies. Least of all himself, from some of the descriptions in some of the films. But yeah.
Well, as he said, the only accidents they had were from the extras drinking too much and getting into fights, and Kinski shooting the tip of a finger off one because they got too drunk one night.
Yeah.
And he's the only guy who's got like his own private hut, and he basically got really annoyed with the noise they were making, so he came out with his rifle and started shooting at the hut, and ended up shooting the tip of a extra's finger.
Yeah, 40 of them in this hut, mate, drinking away, and he didn't kill somebody. It's a miracle.
And Herzog's bedding down with them.
Yeah.
There's no like special director's treatment. The only person getting special treatment is Kinski.
Oh, he's getting mineral water shipped in. They're all drinking muddy river water. And this river is, I mean, he spends quite a lot of time with shots of the river. I mean, it's muddy and dirty, and this is not spring water, is it? This is I guess it's the Amazon, is it, in Peru? It looks disgusting. I think Herzog says he's drinking the river water.
He did. He also said that working in this environment was just another forest.
Mm.
And it's just if you go with the right preparations, it's dealable with. Even despite this, he also says that he got bitten multiple times by fire ants when he cut down the wrong branch.
Mm.
He got attacked by the monkeys. So he's not without injury. And I mean, let's also remember, Herzog is 27 when he's doing this film.
Mm.
And for a little bit of background on the actual filming here, he writes the screenplay in about 2.5 days. And this is mainly while he's on tour with his soccer team. Over the course of this tour, his team consumed the beer that they brought for their opponents, causing the goalie at one point to throw up over his typewriter, causing many pages to have to be disposed of because they were just disgusting. And he says that he's just like writing like a madman. He has this idea, he's just churning out all these pages. And he's working not from a historical context, but just what he believed would have happened. So everything is, he's not going for like historical accuracy. And yet, as you said already, it's like you just took a documentary crew back in time when you look at this film. He's also shooting the film on one camera, and that's a camera he stole from a film institute and would use for a further 8 films. But he believed it was a calling from the camera that he was to take it.
Yeah, this all sounds like Herzog. Just does, doesn't it? I don't know. There's quite often his films, just the story of their making, or like I say, he's quite a good self-publicist, but I believe most of what he says. It's not quite guerrilla filmmaking, because there's more to it than that. He has got a script in mind. He just amends it as he goes along, as the situation demands. And again, I think he just very simply, as we get on and as the film gets more and more crazy, as it gets more and more Heart of Darkness, he doesn't over-explain anything. He just says, yeah, they're losing their minds. There's nothing special. I'm not doing any special imagery. They're just losing their minds. And I like that kind of honesty about him. But anyway, yes. So where are they? They're four rafts going down the river.
Yeah, these rafts were made by local tribes, and they used these rafts themselves to like transport cattle down the river as well. So they're sort of double layered.
Mm.
So the cattle themselves said that they felt like no concern, but they, all the shots of them going down the river, these are all single take shots. And as you mentioned already, water gets on the lens, and the whole time it's Herzog who's filming this with one camera
from a speedboat that he's got. Yeah,
which he insists on driving because he understands the speed.
Yeah,
which I think is just an excuse just to bomb around the Proven River in a speedboat. Right?
I think so. Although very clever. I mean, very cleverly manages not to get the wake showing in shots. And he in the commentary, he said, "Oh, no, here's a bit where you could see where we were staying. Here's a bit where you can see the wake of my speedboat." Anything, but actually, I didn't notice any of that. So,
until
we showed it,
when the sedan chair is going to fall over, and you can see his hand coming to camera to put it back up. He's very good at like pointing out the little flaws in the film.
Yeah,
but even when like water goes on the lens, it doesn't detract from anything.
No, because it's like showing. It feels like a documentary's being made. It, apart from there's, you know, like I say, there's voiceovers by Carvajal, and there's clearly, you know, there's everything. Most of the plot points are clearly planned and happened, and something's going to happen later that obviously isn't in a documentary when someone gets decapitated and someone gets hung and stuff like that. But it's just got that cinema verite, this feel of being a documentary and something which will be replicated a decade later by a bunch of horror films and things like that, right? That use that conceit. But here it's just, yeah, we've gone back in time instead. Love it.
The film's also unique in the fact it only has the one POV. We're only ever following this one group. We only see their side of the story. We don't see the side from, we don't have like cutaways to back in Spain or what the tribe are viewing things
well,
as.
I mean that's right. So yeah, it absolutely stays within the context of these people on these boats. I mean, but it very quickly gets down to one raft, right? because yeah, basically one raft of people get trapped in a whirlpool or eddy, I think the subtitles call it, and as often happens in this film, off screen something happens and suddenly they're all dead. And this happens a lot in this film, that off screen something happens and characters are dead. And yes, but you don't see that happen. You'd oversee the Indians, the native people that are killing them all with arrows and stuff throughout the film. We see a brief glimpse of them in one scene. The rest of the time they're just hidden, and it's just with these people. And yeah, and basically we're with Aguirre. Most of the time he's sitting there snarling around in this, I mean, Kinski's like this beast of a man. He's the most un-Spanish looking person you'll ever see. You know, he's pale and blonde, and he's also like Richard III in this film, isn't he? He's got a limp and he holds one of his arms strangely, and it's this...
Oh yeah, because he was designed to have a hunch.
Right.
So this is why when you look at his uniform, he's got all the straps on the back, and it's like doubling himself over, and the fact that his sword rests higher because of his arm.
Yeah.
So the way that he's designed, he's like very distinctive throughout this film, even with like Kinski's obviously visage there. He's just... he's this constant presence, because for myself the film really, the two key players in this are obviously Aguirre and brother Carvajal. And Carvajal's the supposedly the voice of reason in this group, because everyone else has got their own sort of agendas, and as the film goes on they're all falling prey to these delusions, and they get in like a almost like a jungle fever, because they start like forming their own society. They forget the mission that they're on. They all become so fixated on the fact they're going to get the city of gold and they're going to form their own empire. And we see it with Guzman, who takes on the role of emperor, when they do away with Usura.
Well, that's right. So they basically this quarter of their party are killed for some reason. They end up sort of getting on shore, and Aguirre manages to basically instigate a mutiny against Ursua.
Yeah.
But cleverly make sure that, what's the fella called? De Guzman is set up as emperor, you know, basically is a fake emperor. And they write a letter to King Philip of Spain, telling him that they are basically seceding from the Kingdom of Spain. And yeah, the idea is that this mysterious city of gold, this El Dorado, is they're gonna get all the riches, and they're going to set up their own country, and de Guzman is going to be the emperor of it. Obviously he's a puppet emperor, because really it's really clever, because Aguirre does not want to, he doesn't sort of set himself up as the leader. He always makes sure he's second in command, but really he's everyone's his puppet, right? They're all fucking terrified of him because he's a nutter. But he's also really restrained. But we see him do crazy things. But all the people do what he says. There's a scene, isn't there, where they're voting for de Guzman to become the emperor. And, I don't know, about half the people put their hands up and say yes. And then Aguirre just looks at them. Whether they're Spanish or the native people, they just slowly put their hands up and do the voting. He doesn't have to say anything. He's just... he's Kinski, and you will do what he says, and it's glorious. He's got these eyes, isn't he? As an actor, the way he looks, and he's all the sort of armor and stuff they're wearing sort of kind of hides their heads quite a lot. But Aguirre's eyes, Kinski's eyes, are just these are both haunted and demanding, and this is what attracted to me the film the very first time I saw it. It's just astonishing, and it's just crazy.
Well, yeah, I mean, won't see when it comes to Kinski's outfit. I mean, he's the only one with a really sort of heavily customized outfit, and again, this drove Kinski nuts, because he would just like be finick over every single like button and buckle on the outfit, and the other guys were basically in just stock, the stock armor that the Herzog picked up in Spain. And because it's all shot in sequence as well, you get to this wonderful effect of like seeing how the armor starts to rust as the further they sort of descend into madness as they go down the river. So it starts off all shiny and silver, and then by the end of the film, it's all like rusted and corroded and falling apart. And it's this real great representation of like just mental state when you look at like the state of their clothes and stuff. It becomes more frayed and destroyed, much like their minds that are the further they go along. And even the raft they're on starts like falling apart. And it's kind of funny as well when we look at the two girls that are with them, in particular the mistress, who somehow has this whole regal gown when she decides that she's lost complete faith in the expedition and just wanders off into the jungle. She appears in this like regal gown that she's somehow been squirreling away somewhere. And when Herzog is questioned about this in the film, he's sort of like, we shouldn't be like accountants and question where things are. We should just accept them. And it's like, oh, I guess that explains that way then.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. Also, I'm guessing, he doesn't say it outright, but my impression is that this film is made sequentially, right? Because...
yes, that's correct.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's... you know, there's no... it's just... it's been edited for content, not edited for order. And everything's just, and that's why they look so more and more ragtag as the film goes on. Like you say, the armour starts rusting, their hair grows. It's crazy. But to bless her, you know, is it Ines? Is that her name? The mistress character does always look very well turned out.
But yes.
Yes, when she does put on that dress, which is clearly to represent I mean, she's not. She's a mistress. I mean, she's a what's the word? You know, she's a half caste. She's a local woman that is the mistress of a Spanish conquistador. But she has this element of regality about her. All she's done is care for Ursula. Yes, and then at that point, that is the point when they've gone and attacked that village and burnt everything down, and other things happen. She just goes, you just sit in it. She just resigns. Do you know what? I'd rather take my chances in the jungle, and I'm going to last about 5 minutes than be with this bunch of nutters and disappears. But again, it's also quite mystical, isn't it? Because you don't know. We never hear from her again, and the film calls it out and says, yeah, we don't know. She's just disappeared. And that's kind of nice. There is a kind of mysticism about it as well.
There's a number of people in this film who just disappear, such as the guy who gets hoisted up into the tree.
Yes.
The first time we get the instance of like the fact that the
they're being tracked.
Local tribes are taking them out, and you see him like hoist up, and then the guy's has the blood like drip down his helmet, and he looks up and he's like, ah.
It is all the blood in this film is very Hong Kong blood, isn't it? It's very Shaw Brothers, the blood.
Yeah, it's very red. They really need to add a little couple of drops of green in there to darken it up, but instead we have that sort of like bright oxygenized blood.
Yeah, because we see it on the trees. We see it at the end, like when the monk is killed. It looked very like, God, this could be a Shaw Brothers movie. Sort of the blood that's coming out of him, but that's okay because it's kind of hyper real. It's like surreal, hyper real, whatever you want to say, call it. Anyway, because we're not even sure by the end of the film what's really real. Anyway, what's happening, what's in their minds. But I mean, there's another spectacular shot later on, but we'll get there.
Yeah, and when we have the first tribal village that they come to, they just basically like burn it down, and they find out that this tribe are a group of cannibals.
Hmm.
There's a mummy in the village, and that was actually brought over by Herzog's brother, but because they couldn't put it into the storage on the plane, they actually had to buy a seat, so they had to sit next to this mummy to bring it over.
Of course they did.
And the plane, and speaking of obviously like planes, the first plane that they were supposed to fly them out actually crashed. It was sort of like the last minute they got taken off the passenger list. And there was about 40 people who died in this plane crash. This plane crashed into the jungle. And there was a 17-year-old girl who walked out of the jungle. She survived. And that's the subject of the documentary Wings of Hope.
Yes. So again, this is a little bit of, again, so sometimes adding a bit of fiction. So it is true he was meant to be on the plane. So it wasn't the whole, in the commentary he makes out, doesn't he, that it's like they were all flying out, right? But actually it was a pre-visit that he was making, like for like location scouting visit. So it was just him that didn't get on the plane. Because you think about it, it doesn't really make sense why 40 people would mysteriously not be allowed on a plane that they've booked onto, whereas one person makes sense. But yes, astonishing that he missed that flight. And like you say, everybody on that flight died apart from one girl. And he did later on make a documentary about her, which is, it's just more about the mythology of this film, isn't it? It's just crazy. And you know, that film therefore can be seen as a sort of a spin-off from this one. Fitzcarraldo obviously has got such similar themes, and Kinski, and set in a sort of similar place, and that they're often viewed as a pair of films as well. But I think you definitely include that film as well as part of almost like a trilogy that these films all belong together. Herzog in the Jungle films.
Yes, indeed. And he also would do Rescue Dawn, wouldn't he, with Christian Bale, which was his dramatisation of Little Dita Needs to Fly, the story that Dieter Dangler went through. But the village that they burned down was actually an abandoned village that they bought, and it doesn't get a question like the fact is it like safe to light fires in the middle of a rainforest? And Herzog says, oh, there's no way to control fires. It's like, and then just leaves it at that. It just like says like how much of the rainforest he managed to burn down like filming this.
I mean, like I say, health and safety are not part of 1970 Herzog's vocabulary, is it? I mean, the way he's treating his actors, the way he's treating the local environment. I mean, flying mummies across, going on, you know, filming people next to ravines. They're all catching dysentery and God knows what other diseases. There's, we, you know, we'll get to the 400 fucking monkeys that he brings over that he just releases. There's a horse gets chucked into the river a bit later on that didn't look terribly comfortable to me. I think with a modern eye, this film could never be made, right? In the present day.
Exactly. He says that this film couldn't be made in Hollywood. So he already puts this like little distinction between what he's obviously shooting and what Hollywood was shooting. And he openly admits that like if we shot this on studio sets, then our budget's gone in 3 days. The only way to shoot it is to go to the Peruvian jungle and shoot this. And the river he actually crossed himself, because he, for all his qualms about health and safety, he didn't see it as like being fit for like anyone else to cross the river. So he had a bat, had like a football that he held onto, and he swam across the river to run the cable across so that they could get people across from one side of the river to the other.
Oh, for sure. He's not, he's not like some dictator that's making people do things he's not willing to do himself. He's absolutely complicit in this and an active participant in it. And I guess that, you know, and I feel like all those extras, all those sort of native Peruvian types all seem to love him. They kept on coming, but when they got a bit rowdy, he made sure their characters were killed off that day.
Yeah, that was his rule. Is so like if you misbehave, your character gets killed off quicker.
It's fantastic.
Where's the panpipe player? It's just some beggar he found on the streets of Peru.
Yeah, with sort of mental illness or something. I mean, unfortunately, he uses a word that we don't use anymore in that commentary, but I think that's possibly because English isn't his first language. But yeah, it's just a guy, a beggar from the streets, and he just liked him. But he seems so happy to be part of the film. And there's like a moment, isn't there, sort of the last shot of him. He says, yeah, I just let the camera rest on him for a bit. He looked really happy in that moment.
And he really takes on this unofficial role as a guru. He's like a squire. Like instead of having the lute, he's got a panpipe that he just plays instead. And a lot of the time when he's playing it, he'll be standing next to a guire who's just he's like sitting there like posing glaring at people.
He goes at one stage, doesn't he? So after he's chopped the guy's head off and everything, he goes, morale's a bit low. Play him a tune. I mean, there is also this weird thing about this movie that everyone is speaking German, but pretending to be acting as Spanish, and everyone seems to be able to speak the native Indians' languages as well. You know, apart from, obviously, there's those two, aren't they, that come. There are two Indians that sort of, a man and a woman, aren't there, that come on their little canoe. Yeah, they meet
a pair of tribes people who they use as the justification that there is a sea god, because one of them's got like a gold ingot around his neck, and Guzman's sort of like, where did you get this? And he's like, it sort of like furthers his own delusion of this gold's out there, and they're just like not telling him where it is.
Yeah, and then sort of, but they can't. They have one of the sort of the local Indians who says in another scene that he was a prince of his people and now he's a slave. But he's used as a kind of interpreter, isn't he? But he can speak these people language, which I think also talks to the fact they never really get very far down this river. I don't think they ever get more than about 10 miles down the river in reality. But it feels like it's been some epic journey. But yes, and then Carvajal, the monk, says, do you know the word of Jesus Christ? And goes straight into full preacher mode. And the male native guy picks it up and says, "Have you heard the word of God?" And he picks it up and he puts it to his ear and says, "No, I can't hear it." I laugh, and then they kill him because that's the Catholic Church for you. Again, it's very critical. I think Herzog is a Catholic, but he's incredibly critical of Catholicism and the whole missionary movement in this movie. But yes, they're the only people, I think, that can't understand what's being said. So there's an element of disbelief that we have to maintain that these people speaking German are Spanish, and everyone is speaking German, even the Peruvians. It's very strange, but you get to deal with it, don't you? Especially as I suspect you're watching it in subtitles, or there is a dub.
I was watching the subtitled version. I mean, this film is readily available everywhere. Mm. You can watch it on YouTube, you can watch it on Freevee. It's very easy to get hold of. So, and even like the commentary track, you can get on YouTube. So
I will. I mean, I own it on DVD, right? But when you said it was on Freevee, I thought, I'll give Freevee a go, because it's all integrated into Amazon, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
And I have to say, Freevee is the worst fucking streaming platform in the world. Two reasons. One is the adverts just appear at random times. They can appear in the middle of a scene, and it's just dreadful. At least if you're watching it through your Amazon Prime subscription, you can resume it. If you're not, it always goes back to the beginning every time you stop. But also, for some reason, it played an episode of Judge Judy straight after.
Oh yeah, they look just shitty, don't they?
It's a very, very weird platform, and I'm not entirely sure why Amazon just haven't fully wrapped it into Amazon Prime. But hey ho, they bought it off IMDb, didn't they? And a very strange platform. But like you say, it's readily available.
Now the music is provided by Popol Vuh, another of Herzog's friends. They played football together. He's also a member of the West German progressive krautrock band. What do you think of the soundtrack here? I really like it. It's sort of non-invasive. It's sort of in the background. It has this mystical edge to what we're watching here, really, especially because we're going, as I said, deep into the Peruvian jungle, which has got its own mystique to it. And then you add this like choir like music.
It gets him to invent this sort of, does he call it a choir organ or something like that?
Yeah, that's he created the instrument, which is like 36 tapes running parallel to each other in loops.
Yeah, which seems incredibly technological, but the sound that's coming out of it is it's got that sense of otherworldliness. It's got a very much a sense of South America to it. To me, you know, obviously we have the pan pipes as well, which is adding to that. And I guess it also has that sense of, you know, there's that whole Catholicism thing about a monk and chanting and stuff like that. It's lovely. I personally found it non-intrusive. Yeah. It's just there and it feels right. But at the same time, there is a lot of time where you're just hearing the rush of the water, you're hearing the insects, you're hearing the whoosh of arrows. Do you know what I mean? It's not like this incredible oral experience, but it makes utter sense within the context of the film. There's no pop songs over the end credits or anything like that. It's consistent, and again, just another part of what makes this a this feels like almost documentary style. I'll keep saying it because that's my thing. But I liked it a lot.
So by the time we obviously get to the end of this film and the rations are so low, they're counting out individual grains while Guzman is still living up his emperor fantasies. Even like there's a great scene where he like asks for wine and they just give him lake water. He holds out his cup and he's like, yeah. Just like takes it out of the river.
Again, a commentary on royalty. Obviously Spain at the time was a monarchy, and I'm guessing Guzman's a stand-in for King Philip. Is it King Philip II at this time? I can't remember. My knowledge of 16th century Spanish kings could be better. Although this is sort of the era of the Armada and stuff. Yeah, I think it is. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he's a stand-in for that, and he's showing, you know, he's completely disconnected from them. He's eating all the food. They're eating ears of corn. And then, like you say, they give him river water for wine. And then he gets all about, oh, that horse is pissing me off. Him and the horse haven't got on the entire movie. And he basically tells them to push the horse off the boat. And that's a sad bit. You know, the horse doesn't look terribly comfortable. Then it swims to shore. And then it waits on the shore, doesn't it? Sort of saying, well, if you left me behind, I was quite happy.
Even though it's such a beautiful shot.
And I've got to imagine a horse did not like being on that raft all the time. But yes, it is a beautiful shot. And we sort of float away from it. And it's sitting there. And it's got its it's got some sort of, I'm not going to say a cape and a mask. It's not a superhero. But it's got some kind of sort of military cloaking on it, and it just sits there and stares at us and says goodbye. And then one of the best lines on it is that the monk says to one, that was a week's worth of meat.
Yeah, they point out the fact they could have eaten the horse. Which just really goes to show just like how out of their depth that they are.
They've really done a really, all on the behest of their declared emperor.
Yes. And so by the time they get to the second village that they come across, and they find a patch of salt, and you see three guys basically licking salt off the floor because they're so deprived of resources.
Yeah, that's at this point, so dehydrated. Although that is the worst thing you could do when you're dehydrated, to lick salt. But yes, that's what they do too. Of course, then Guzman, of course, that's the last stand for him, because in the next shot, he's been killed. We don't know who by. I have my suspicions.
No, there's a lot of questions that are left unanswered, especially when it comes to people being dispatched and all. And we see, as they float down the river, they see a boat that's in a tree. That was going to play more of a central theme in the film, but it ended up being cut, and instead it just becomes this hallucination that they believe they see.
But has been taken from the historical record, right? I can't remember which of the stories he's taken it from, but there is a story that says that one of the groups of conquistadors that went down the Amazon did see this tree in the, you know, in a place that it couldn't possibly be, because that it would never flood that high. It's 120 feet in the air, isn't it?
Yeah.
But for the purposes of this, we see it. And we know one of the conquistadors can see it, but all the others are telling him, no, it's not there. But then Aguirre seems to believe he can see it, doesn't he? So it must be there. And it's having a joint hallucination, because he thinks we could go and get that boat, and then we can go and get over to the Atlantic and go back to Spain or something. Oh, no, he wants to go to Trinidad or somewhere. Yeah, he wants to go take over somewhere in the West Indies. That's right, yeah. He's lost it by that point. I mean, as well, it's very clear as the film reaches its conclusion. You know, he feels he wants to be the king, the emperor himself of this world.
He does, and he also has some very questionable ideas about marrying his daughter,
who by this point has died. But yes, yeah. He wants to marry his daughter and raise the most perfect people. And of course, so the sort of two things out of this is, one is that, of course, again, as I hinted before, he's the whitest, most Aryan man you've ever seen. There are definitely themes of eugenics and stuff going on here that I think, obviously, as a German director, he's, you know, I did say at the beginning he's not big on symbolism and stuff like that. I'm pretty certain he's going for a thing there. In the real world, Lope de Aguirre actually killed his own daughter and dismembered her. So I don't know which is worse, mate. I really don't. But yes, she dies. I mean, she's very, other than a few furtive looks, she's not actually in the movie as much, is she? You don't really see her.
No, the female characters are very sort of pushed to the side. They're normally hidden away for the majority of the film, yeah. And they occasionally appear now and again within the film, which I suppose is really for the best, because when you've got a bunch of like grotty guys, and they do obviously hint that there's a little bit of threat. There's the the guy who's there going la 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 la, and Herzog was saying that, you know, when he was trying to get him to do the la's, he was trying to do it in too much of like a tune, and he was saying no, you gotta just do it in like very much monotone, and it adds that layer of fret to it. But frankly, that's as threatening as it gets towards the female cast members. We don't see anything horrific happen to them. In fact, the worst thing sort of they do to themselves.
Well, it's their lust for gold. It's their lust for not even power. Yeah, they all seem to be driven by this desire to find riches and gold. I think even though there are two female characters in this film, they barely say a word, either of them. And they're both very subservient to individual men. Like, the daughter's very subservient to her father, and no one dares talk to her, obviously, because Aguirre would probably rip them to pieces. And the other lady is obviously absolutely dedicated to her. Well, she's, I don't know what it's called when you're the mistress to someone. I don't want to call her master, because that doesn't have the right words. But whatever it is, you know, she's in love with this guy, and that's it. And there's nothing else. There's no.
I don't think he has a title. I think you are just the mistress. It's,
yes, I don't know. I don't know.
To basically identify your surplus.
Yeah, I don't know what he is to her. Her lover, her whatever. But
I would assume that would be what you can if you want to apply a title to things. And that, but, yes, it would be that would be what it is.
Yeah, but there is no, you know, it doesn't ever get rapey or anything like that, or male gazy, does it? Like
it gets very Kinski gazy.
It does. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There is obviously that hint that he, certainly with his daughter, you know, there are.
Oh, I was talking just more with the camera. It just lingers more on Kinski.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. I see what you mean. You're doing for the male gazing. Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, the camera's constantly circling him. Yeah, the boat that is constantly circling him. He's always turning and facing the camera. The camera fucking loves this guy. This guy who is not handsome. He's not, you know, he's got crazy eyes and craggy skin and unkempt hair, yet he has got film charisma.
He feels more historically accurate, though, because of this. Because we see, like, so many times in, like, historical productions and stuff, you have, like, these GQ-looking model types that are, like, playing the roles of gladiators or centurions or whatever. And Kinski looks like is generally one of the few people who looks historically correct.
Although, ironically, obviously, he wasn't. The original Aguirre was a short little black-haired man, apparently. But I get what you mean, yeah? Most people look like people who live next door to you or the weirdo down the street or whatever, right? That's what Kinski looks like. He doesn't look like a one-in-a-million super handsome man with perfect skin and perfect teeth and perfect hair. And I'm pretty sure if you lived in the 16th century and you're a member of the Spanish invading army, you would look, you know, you'd have teeth missing, you'd have bad skin, your hair would be unkempt, you've been in the South American jungle on a raft, you would look like this, right? I applaud the film for that.
It's funny you say that. I mean, I was doing a bit of reading today on the Court of Versailles, and they were like saying that if you ran a marathon, then got in a time machine and went to Versailles, you would still be head and shoulders above everyone else.
Mm.
Because bathing really wasn't a thing, and if it was, the whole household, starting with the father, would you share the same bathwater until it became too infested or full of parasites to use.
Oh, I mean, this is why, you know, and at that time, you know, even the makeup they used that was full of lead would rot their skin away. That's why they had to keep wearing it. And, you know, things like beauty spots were actually the lead poisoning people's skin. And yeah, wash and even our concepts of, you know, hot water and soap is a fairly recent invention that, you know, people really didn't understand about being clean or what it meant. I guess they had other protections, but yeah, I think if we went back in time today, mate, the world would stink. If we went to London in the 16th, 17th century, it would stink of horse shit and people shit.
Well, it's basically an open sewer at that point,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. So. But I think, you know, that wasn't unique to London. That was the world, right? because that's what we didn't understand.
So yeah, that was obviously Agree with Wrath of God. A big recommendation from both of us, I believe, now. So
I fucking love this movie. I've got to be honest with you. First scene, last scene, all the stuff in the middle. And if you want to watch a movie about someone travelling down a South American river, I'd rather watch this than Apocalypse Now.
I would say it's a really great double feature.
Yeah, I mean, they're both clearly... I mean, obviously, this did inspire Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
It's been... Yeah, Coppola has said as much. And, you know, they're both very much Heart of Darkness inspired, clearly, as well. So, yes, absolutely, 100%. And it's only 90 minutes long. It's amazing.
It's your turn to choose where we go in the world next, and where would you like to go follow this up with?
Okay, I'm going to go something a little bit more modern. I'm going to choose a Mexican film, so Spanish language, from 2020, by director, I think it's Miquel Franco, called New Order, which sort of basically sort of tells a story of a modern revolt in Mexico and a class war, basically, when the poor rebel against the rich. It's quite a controversial movie, but I really enjoyed it, and I'm hoping you'll find something to like about it as well. It's on Mubi. Oh, fantastic.